I would submit that there were three major motives behind that great mass of printed work. In the first place, there was a popular writer who was quite frankly popular, appealing to a certain given audience and trying to produce the sort of written material that that audience required. That was the branch of literature, if literature as it is to be called, which was a sort of industry. It was what H.G. Wells once called the production of trade goods. There was a second group, which I find very puzzling within this period, work produced by men of high talent, well written, alert, enterprising in its form, but written for a public that was indolent, a public that was never anxious to stretch its intelligence, to explore its emotions too deeply, a public that was, above all, not anxious for experiment, not anxious to be hurt, disturbed, or too profoundly moved. One can see a number of writers, indeed some of the most effective writers, within this interwar period, who are answering the needs of that particular public, a public which is largely urban, which has a rather sedentary, regulated life, that looks to literature only for some sort of excitement, which is looks for the expression of a life a little more precarious than its own existence, but is afraid of the creative artist. I sometimes feel that Mr. Priestley, for instance, who is so successful in this period since the publication in 1929 of The Good Companion, is supremely that writer of talent who is never transgressing beyond a certain degree of difficulty, novelty of approach, and the like, and yet who certainly doesn't belong to the first group of writers, who has powers of dialogue, arrangement of theme, social comment, all which are highly intelligent and governed by a talent which is extraordinarily prolific and quite considerable by any standard of that. But there does exist within the period a third group of writers who seem to me to have a more definitely creative quality. They are frequently less successful than the writers of talent that I've been dealing with, that I've mentioned. Their work is less complete. But they have an awareness of the changing values of these decays, which are not possessed by anyone else. Now, one of the difficulties of the creative writer in this interwar period is that if he remains true to whatever vision he may possess, he never achieves any large audience. He never achieves any congenial or happy relationship to the exact society in which he exists. If one judges this for a moment from poetry, I think one can say that there is only one volume of poetry throughout the whole of this period between the two wars that ever had a large circulation. Tennyson, Kipling, Tennyson in his middle and later period, Kipling at any period, were able to rely upon a large reading public. Tennyson in his middle and later years, was able to produce a first edition of any of his work of 10,000 copies. Little green cloth-covered books, which many of you must have seen, which, as Sir John Squire once said, settled like green fly upon all the drawing room tables of England. There was no poet in this interwar period who could rely upon an audience in that way. And the only volume that I can think of is Robert Bridges' Testament of Duty. Robert Bridges had been writing poetry from the period of 1873, always writing in a way in which he himself approved, but which never won any wide approval from the public. And then, as a really old man, in 1929, he writes this long philosophical poem of Beauty in a World of Reason, published in 1929, which in many ways was the last of the hopeful years in Western Europe. And suddenly, unexpectedly, he gains the sort of popularity that a volume of popular fiction gained. Whether, of course, the verdict of time will justify the public in selecting that particular work as the only work that is to have wide popularity, well, the future can judge. If, for instance, one deals with the actual sale of a writer who, although he doesn't belong to this period, became popular for the first time in this period, Gerard Manley Hopkins, whose first volume was published in 1918, published by Robert Bridges, and who was a subject of wide comment, one finds that the actual sales are very limited. It is a number of years before there is any call for a second edition of Gerard Manley Hopkins' poetry. In fact, theses were published on Gerard Manley Hopkins before the public had called for a second edition of his work. One feels that almost that the thesis writers must only have borrowed a poet's work, which does seem a certain unfairness. There is one group of writers whom I think can perhaps be most easily, perhaps inaccurately, but crudely, described as philosophical liberals. I always feel myself that they centered in Maynard Keynes, who, if he had not given his life to economics, might have been an artist, and who is remembered, I suppose, in his later period as Lord Keynes for his debt-adjusting controversies and conference. But Keynes was the friend of a group of Cambridge writers who had a very considerable influence in this period. And I think there is much in Keynes's own economic consequences of the peace, the book that he wrote at Versailles, which shows, first of all, that he had the eye and appreciation of an artist, and which secondly shows this sense of despair, this sense of the consequence of the inadequacy of the human instrument to deal with the contemporary problems with which it is faced. If I may read one passage, Keynes is describing one of the conferences of Versailles in the Hall of Mirrors, and speaking of President Wilson, and of the Prime Minister, Mr. Lloyd George. And this is how he describes the scene. "My last and most vivid impression is of such a scene. The President and the Prime Minister as the center of a surging mob and a babel of sound, a welter of eager, impromptu compromises and counter-proposals, all sound and fury signifying nothing on what was an unreal issue anyway. The great issues of the morning's meeting forgotten and neglected. And Clemenceau, silent and aloof, on the outskirts, for nothing that touched the security of France was forward. Clemenceau, throned in grey gloves on the brocade chair, dry in soul, empty of hope, very old, very tired, but surveying the scene with a cynical and almost impish air. Three of Keynes's friends were Lytton Strachey, E.M. Forster, and Virginia Woolf. I don't wish this evening to go over the familiar ground of Strachey's contribution. I would only say that this passage that I've read from Keynes seems to me very parallel to that conception of biography with which Strachey won such wide acceptance. It was a biography that seemed a sort of agnosticism of biography, a biography that was based upon a disbelief in the human instrument. But I would, if I may, like to say just one word about Morgan Foster, about E.M. Forster. Although chronologically, so much of his work lies outside this period, it seems to me that he did represent that philosophical liberal whose spirit was broken by the First World War and by the mood, values, consequences of the First World War. Foster, in the work which immediately precedes that First World War, still had a sense of confidence in the importance of private emotion, of the private life, of studies, of art, a life that can be lived with certain elegance, a certain indulgence, perhaps, if the word is to be treated in its more refined way. It all comes out in a description which he gives of King's College, Cambridge, in his life of Lowes Dickinson. He describes there what he regards as a civilized approach to life, body and spirit, reason and emotion, work and play, architecture and scenery, life and seriousness. These pairs, which were everywhere contrast, everywhere else contrast, were there fused into one. People and books reinforced one another. Intelligence joined hands with affection. Speculation became a passion. And discussion was made profound by love. Now, although Foster gained a wider reputation with the passage to India, there is one work, Howard's End, known, I'm sure, to all of you, which seems to me to give the clearest, fullest picture of that civilized life and of the values of that civilized life, with all its weight upon the personal life, upon personal relationships, which the First World War destroyed. The reason why Foster seems to wear so well in the harsher decades that were to follow is, to my mind, based upon the fact that although he was a liberal, he had a consciousness of the active and dynamic power of evil. Unlike so many of his fellow liberals, he did not think that evil was something that could be easily eradicated by social adjustment. There's a passage which many of you will recall in The Howard's End, where this is brought out. It's a passage where one of the characters describes to another Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. There is nothing more difficult than to put into words the effects of music. But Foster seems to do it here successfully. One person going to another, to a concert with another person, tells the other person all what the music is about. A very tedious thing in actual life, but used effectively by Foster in this particular instance. And the concept of evil, which is mentioned in this text, is described by Foster as the goblin. Maybe a strange way of describing evil, but the goblin is the way in which he does describe it here. Look out for the part where you think you have done with the goblin, and they come back, breathed Helen as the music started up again.